It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go at midweek on this, the 30th day of August, 2017. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you'd like to pick yourself out a screen name and a password there under the tab chat room and jump in and join the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, multimedia, real-time extravaganza that is the chat room during the hours in which this program is live, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Once you're in there, you'll be met by Anatole and Earther and Hoghead and Laborman and Silent R. Lamar and V.T. Blom with capable moderation by midweek utility pinch hit chat room moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgia Stan. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I'm in there, too. And we'll be happy to see you if you decide to wander by. As noted, we are at midweek. It is Wednesday. Ordinarily, we would do the prayer meeting Wednesday shtick. Yes, thank you, Earther. Look, Ma, it's that Bob Kincaid fella on the radio again. If you're looking at the radio, well, never mind. But, yeah, thanks. Thanks, Earther. We're at the midweek position. Ordinarily, we would do the prayer meeting Wednesday shtick. I'm kind of going to dispense with that this week, just simply because, I don't know. We got prayer meeting Wednesday stuff to do. There's no doubt about that. But to be quite honest, the Joel Osteen thing is so obscene and so disgusting that even the fun that we ordinarily poke at those freaks seems entirely just nasty, because it, in a way, gives them a pass. Oh, they're just wacky, well-meaning, right? Yeah. I will note here at the beginning of the program, and that'll be the end of it, I have thanks to send out. Thank you very kindly to Peg in the Sandbox for helping out overnight. And thanks to our subscriber, Clarence. Thank you, Clarence. Thank you very, very kindly. It's the folks who listen to the program who keep the program going. But that's it. This is a today and tomorrow are non-fundraising programs. We're not gonna. That's it. Just thank you to those who keep the program going and move on from there. I mentioned Joel Osteen after he and his filthy little megachurch. Filthy great big mega church, Lakewood Church, the one in the basketball arena in Houston, were criticized soundly and deservedly so for not doing anything even remotely Christian in their response to Hurricane Harvey. It, you know, when you get into a situation like that, you're pretty much in Matthew 25 land. The very beating heart of Christianity is, at least according to the guy that they built Christianity around, namely Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, is not shitting on people who are hurting. And, well, that's exactly what Joel Osteen and his Lakewood Church did. If there were any justice in the universe, Joel Osteen would be a pauper when this is all over with people crossing the street to get away from him and spitting on the ground at the mere mention of his name or the sight of him. But ABC, for-profit media, reached out to get him on air, and he said, of course, the narrative is that we didn't want to take people in, or we didn't open in time. You know, it's totally not true. We were here for people. We were a shelter. We were taking people as soon as the floodwaters receded when several people came here to take them in. Except for the fact that it was verified early on that the doors of the church basketball arena were locked. And that's always been one of those things that sort of amazed me. Why do churches have locks on doors? When the very essence of what we now call Christianity is openness and a sense of welcome to people in need. Right? It's in Matthew 25. I prefer the King James Version because God speaks a bit Elizabethan English. Where, you know, the rules, these are rules, are put in place. Okay. I was hungered and you gave me meat. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee as hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these my brethren, you have done it also unto me. Then he shall say unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was a-hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an-hungered, or athirst, a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. So, if you judge Joel Osteen by the words of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate rabbi, it's going to get right hot for Joel Osteen where he's headed. Now, by the time ABC got around to interviewing him, he had a nice stack of donated diapers, and there were pictures of flooding outside the church in the Houston, general Houston area. And Osteen pissed and moaned and said, The city has a shelter 4 miles from here.
We work with the city all the time. And when their shelter was totally full, they started bringing people over here. And here again today doing it like we did in 2001 when we housed 3,000 people. So I don't know. I think somebody created that narrative that somehow we were high and dry. And none of that is true. This building was a safety issue. And we took people in from the very beginning.
Yeah, of course, that again is one of those be off to hang with the devil and his angels statements, because it was 80 hours after the hurricane first made landfall before Lakewood Church ever opened its doors. Mm-hmm. At all. And, of course, after the fact,
we were afraid it was going to flood. Last thing we would do is put people in it right at the beginning. But, yeah, we'd probably be, do some things differently, obviously.
Okay. Not really. This guy's got multiple mansions. I mean, that Bible verse about in my Father's house are many mansions? Joel Osteen's not waiting around to see Jesus' daddy's house. He's got him many mansions on earth. And there was a story a few years ago about his wife being really, really abusive toward a flight attendant. Sister Carol Baker points out, I prefer 1 John 3:17 of the New International Version. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need that has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Simple answer. You can't. Okay? Just plain and simple. Just a second here. Okay. No, as Carol points out, simple answer, you can't. His excuse is they forgot to beg. His response was to start a fundraiser. I sent thoughts and prayers to him and Victoria. Are thoughts and prayers deductible, Carol asks? I'm asking for a friend. Mm-hmm. Now, Marty asks, now, do you really think Joel would rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints? And I don't mean the kind of saints that are in New Orleans. Of course, it's finally, apparently, stopped pouring down rain in Houston. The hell on earth has moved on eastward to places like Port Arthur and Beaumont. There are environmental disasters now well underway. An evacuation order was put out earlier because of a profound risk of explosion at a Motiva plant. Everyone who was within a mile and a half of a chemical plant in southeast Texas were told, according to Reuters, to get the hell out as a precautionary measure. Mm-hmm. That happened yesterday. Arkema SA said that its Texas Crosby, Texas plant had become a serious situation. Everybody was evacuated there, and everybody in a mile and a half radius was evacuated too, because
the backup generators for the plant had been swamped by the storm after 40 inches of rain fell. They need to maintain refrigeration for chemicals that they keep on the site. The chemicals are kept at extremely low temperatures. And, you know, if it doesn't stay refrigerated, bad things happen. If there'd been, you know, serious regulations about all that, well, it would have killed jobs. Now it might kill people. Them job-killing regulations. You know, we know all about those here. Mm-hmm. And down in Galveston, I didn't realize this till I read it earlier. You want to get a case of the Fantods? Not really, but you're gonna anyway. This is a terrifying bit of reality. So I never knew about this one particular place. I'd never heard from it before. Till I ran across this story. There's always a question of reporting in the middle of all this. There's something down in Galveston. Let me see if I can pull this together in a semblance of sense. There are some misgivings about Galveston National Laboratory. It's a biological laboratory, oddly enough, in Galveston, Texas. Now, a lab that works with things like what they work with at Galveston National Laboratories, you can't help but wonder about the wisdom of parking it right smack dab in a place that is known to get whacked by hurricanes. Not just this one. They work on viruses and nasty little bugs that are really, really dangerous. It's classified as a high-security national biocontainment lab. And they work on what they describe on their website as therapies, vaccines, and diagnostic tests for naturally occurring emerging diseases such as SARS, West Nile encephalitis, and avian influenza, as well as for microbes that might be employed by terrorists. Journalists have had a hard time getting anywhere near Galveston National Labs. And it's one of those generators, one of those generator things where they've got generators, but they have to be fueled. They can't run indefinitely. They're not wind or solar powered. No. And if the if no one gets to, if they can't fuel the generators, among other things, well, University of Illinois professor Francis Boyle, an expert in biological weapons, said, as I see it, the existential problem is this: what happens if and when the fuel for the backup generators runs out? The negative air pressure that keeps the bugs in there ends, and the bugs can then escape. There has been subsequent reporting that, no, the generators are working fine, and Galveston National Labs are just fine. And God, you hope they are. But the question remains, why is it down there where it can get whacked? Flooded, blown over, whatever. And there's not really a particularly good answer to that question. So, you know, hopefully... And that's all that we got now, hope. And that's one of the problems here. In the midst of a massive crisis along the Texas Gulf Coast and extending toward Louisiana, an area that is absolutely chock-a-block with the chemical and oil industry, and God only knows how many different toxins. Well, there wasn't much interest, apparently, in preparing for something that was absolutely 200 proof, 100% certain to happen at some point or another. The legislative history of the state of Texas is a legislative history of Republican lawmakers refusing to deal with anything in the way of disaster preparedness, because the mean old scientists kept talking about how it had to do with climate change. And of course, if you're a Republican, you can't even say climate change, let alone deal with it legislatively. Oh, hell no. We can't have that. All of our political donations from the oil companies and the Koch brothers and shit will dry right up, and then we'll have to live like ordinary people. Damn, what do you want? So every time the Texas legislature's met in the last few years, they've tried to deal with the question: are we prepared for climate change in enhanced storms in areas, low-lying areas that are full of the chemical and petrochemical industries that are extremely vulnerable to this sort of thing, and the surrounding areas that could be poisoned by them if something goes sideways, and the bills go nowhere. Now, I'm sure, and it's 23 minutes past the hour. I'm sure here at 23 minutes past the hour on the 30th day of August, 2017, if some weird little right-wing goddamn troll was listening, he'd say, "Oh, Bob, it's too soon. You goddamn liberals." I'm setting up a straw man and just beating the shit out of him here, in case you're wondering. "You goddamn liberals always got to politicize everything. Don't you know there's a crisis underway? Don't you know people need rescuing?" Well, as a matter of fact, I do. But I also know that the problems, such as they are worse than they would otherwise have to be. How old, you tell me, how old are the warnings about climate change? How long have we known? How long has science been warning, even mildly, about climate change? More than 10 years. More than 20. Well, okay, that's another way of looking at it. Brother Deacon Asa says, don't you worry your fine feathered fundament about it, Bob. My fundament's feathered? Once Donnie is cornered enough, like the filthy little rat that he is, the bugs escaping Galveston National Laboratory will be the least of our concerns. Well, that's true, because there was some more North Korea saber rattling today. That fucker wants to see what a mushroom cloud looks like so bad he can taste it. He'd even borrow a pair of melanoma's pumps if he thought it would give him a better view. Ron and Raleigh asking, would you care to make a wager on this? Could it possibly be that some powerful Texas legislator arm-twisted somebody into citing that lab in the great state of Texas on the Texas Gulf Coast where hurricanes go? I would not take the wager because I can't afford to lose the money. But there are problems that have made this problem worse. And I'm probably going to make somebody mad at me here in a minute. Because it's really easy to point at politicians who have screwed things up in a big way. I mean, for instance, Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eating future king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a really long time, started the ball rolling when he unlimbered himself of a nasty whopper of a great big lie, him being an evangelical Christian. Lying is one of the things he does best, just like Joel Osteen. To the fact that, you know, he voted against them Yankees up there after Sandy because, as he claimed, 2/3 of the bill was pork. And he said, yeah, I want money for the Smithsonian Institution. Well, the Smithsonian Institution was actually damaged during Superstorm Sandy, because it wasn't just what happened on the coastal regions. As I said, we were on the back end of it, and we got a goddamn blizzard that knocked out power for a week and a half, something like that. I remember it well because it was just months after the derecho of 2012 when we'd been out of power for 2-3 weeks. And so there were a lot of places that actually had Sandy damage. But Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eating future king of America, voted against all that relief and voted, and all but one of the Texas delegation voted against that relief. And, of course, now they're walking around, as the old saying goes, crying, Lord, Lord. And so it's easy to blame those bastards. It's easy to blame the bastards in the Texas legislature that have done everything humanly possible to keep from confronting the realities that face them along the Texas Gulf Coast, which is huge, just like Texas, and which they have refused to even remotely try to deal with. And this is the part where I'm going to make somebody mad at me. The bastards who did that, the bastards who rejected any notion of trying to cope with climate change enhanced natural disasters, or frankly, which meant they didn't want to cope with natural disasters at all. Well, they didn't miraculously appear in the Texas legislature. People had to vote for them. And mostly, it was, you know, and I have dear, we have dear friends of the program in Texas.
Our friend Dr. Allen up in Waco leads the Waco Friends of Peace and stands and they go out and they work and they message and they try to inform people like a lone voice crying in the wilderness that climate change is real. And they don't give up. And they don't wither in the face of threats. But they have been, they are raising their voices against a hallelujah chorus of corporate funded, petroleum funded, chemical funded voices saying, no, don't worry about climate change. It's not real. Didn't you hear Trump? Chinese hoax to destroy our manufacturing base. That's what climate... It's not real. We don't have to worry about it. What we need to do is get rid of some more of them job-killing regulations. Because mostly the people who say that kind of thing don't work in the industries where the job-killing regulations would actually save lives. And so for every Republican, I don't know what the exact number is, but for every Republican who has ever voted against dealing with the imminent threats posed by the enhancement of storms as a result of climate change, for every one of those legislators, there are thousands of everyday, workaday, going along, getting along Texans who put them in office. And therein lies one of the demarcations between, say, the area where Sandy struck and the area where Harvey has been ravaging the land. Those blue states. Well, they generally acknowledge climate change, and given the opportunity, would do something about it. But every time we try to do something about it, no matter how minimal, there are people like the legislators and members of Congress who are sent by voters in Texas and Alabama and Louisiana and Mississippi, you know, the Confederacy, who somehow manage to block the process so that a noisy, well-funded minority of people manage to put everyone at risk. Clarity has kindly provided me with a timeline on global warming. And it goes back quite a long way. No time to read the entirety of it. But in 1971, you get a call from a number of leading scientists who report a danger of rapid and serious global change caused by humans. And then the information begins to grow and build from there because, among other things, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has been formed. By 1976, the greenhouse effect has been identified. And so if you look at it that way, yeah, but let's be generous. Let's say 1976. We have had 41 years in which to deal with this looming disaster. And it has largely been stopped or stymied or slowed, whatever pathetic little attempts we have made, every step of the way. Of course, critical to all of this has been the oil industry. And in one of the more interesting, and yeah, Carol, you're right. Carol says, and yet these fucking no-good violent liberals will always vote to save them. Yeah, because what else are you going to do? Are you going to look at them and say, nah, you know, I think it's time we hung you fuckers out to dry until you figure it out for yourselves? There won't be any political fighting over the response money for Harvey recovery. However, it deserves to be noted because we talk about things like FEMA and you know, monies being provided by the federal government. There's a lot of people going to be left hung out to dry. Because FEMA doesn't just come down and start doing the early Kyler thing and passing out big old government money checks. I realize that this is the model that the right wing has created in the minds of God knows how many American citizens. But it is far from the reality. There will be people whose houses are so damaged, and being as they are unable to qualify for loans and won't get much in the way of fix-up money, there's going to be a significant number of people who just walk away from their homes because they have no choice. Because the places are unlivable, and they have no way of dealing with it. Take a look around you. Look at whatever it is you have. And imagine just walking away with whatever you've got on your back. That's going to happen in Houston and Beaumont and Port Arthur and Victoria. And any number of places that have been affected by this storm. I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, I know it. I know some of this for a fact. FEMA came in here after the derecho, and there was no money. I mean, okay, there was some money, but not much. And there was no way we could have ever afforded to take out a loan to replace everything that was ruined or destroyed. We didn't walk away, but we damn sure learned to do without. To this day, we use a little $200 refrigerator from Walmart. To this day, we have no central heat or central air. That got ruined. The stove got ruined. Anything that was plugged into the electricity and didn't have an uninterruptible power supply between the wall and it got fried from the massive power surge that blew through when the antiquated power grid went to hell. And that's just a little bitty disaster.
I remember back during Katrina when people would call the program talking about folks getting sick from the chemicals inside the hastily delivered FEMA trailers, as they were referred to. You learn to do without. Because even the billions of dollars in response money that are going to go down there, and make no mistake, the Harvey affected area is going to get a more generous response than people who were affected by Sandy could even begin to dream of. Since it's prayer meeting Wednesday, we can do a little Bible referencing. It'll be a little bit like the parable of the prodigal son, in which the bad kid gets all the good stuff. The justification being, well, you know, I mean, Would you not celebrate when a bad kid came, you know, when the bad son came back, and wouldn't you? Yeah, well, sure you would. That's sort of just an assumption inside the parable. Clarence, with a note, says, the first time I heard about climate change was at the first Earth Day rally in Philadelphia, April 22nd, 1971. Sounds about right. And I'm sure, you know, if we had any little right wing turds out there in the corners, I'd get shit for what I'm saying now. I hope it doesn't piss you off. Because the goal is not to piss anybody off. The goal is to try to get us to think about ways to eventually mitigate some of this stuff before it happens. It's kind of like what Dr. John said last night. That has had a certain resonance with me. Another failure to plan and prepare. When are we going to get tired of this disaster theater and invest in infrastructure? Wouldn't that be making America great again? That's not the kind of making America great we're interested in, though, is it? Because it's really not exciting. Man, every TV news operation in this country is just wetting itself because of the eyeballs that it has on the screens. It's exciting to watch people being rescued by helicopters and stuff. Because it's happening in real time and it's live. And we can feel really, really good about the decency and the charitableness and the degree to which we say to hell with our differences and we come together to solve a problem. But God Almighty, would it not have been a lot more gratifying to have put our differences aside and come together to solve the problem before it was a problem? But see, they wouldn't have parachuted any journalists in, any TV news, for-profit media types to do that. Because that takes, that's the kind of stuff that takes years. And it's not sexy.
Good evening. We begin tonight's broadcast by showing you a hurricane preparedness barrier preparation, blah, 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 blah.
And the simple fact of the matter is, when all is said and done here, there's a lot of people, I don't want them to walk away, but there needs to be a lot less people in the region. Especially in the places where the millionaire class has built their goddamn gated community, McMansion communities by the sea or on the beach or whatever. And if we were serious about any of this at all, the minute that things are dry enough to begin the conversations, we would call the oil companies and the chemical companies in and say, okay, what are you going to do about this? Obviously, you're not ready for the next one. You weren't ready for this one. You weren't getting ready for this one. You put entire communities at hazard. What are you going to do about it? And as I was saying, one of the more interesting moments in journalism today happened over on MSNBC. Ali Velshi was interviewing Shihab Ratansi, who was a reporter for Al Jazeera America, and was reporting from an area where the floodwaters were at the time rising. And he started talking about what kind of led up to all of this. Let's check in here. You might find this interesting.
Interesting. The reason why it's called the Golden Triangle is because this is the first place in the United States where they discovered large quantities of oil in 1901.
Right.
And that led to the Texas oil boom and the huge amounts of money come pouring into this region. It's pretty clear, though, that despite that, money has not been flowing into this region for the infrastructure, for the climate change effects that we knew were inevitable because of the oil and gas industry's activities on this coastline. Even as those oil and gas industries were covering up what they knew about climate change in the 70s. I have to go on about this. Ali, you're an Al Jazeera guy. We get to the point on Al Jazeera.
Yep.
So that is very striking for us here. So much money has been made on this region.
Shihab, hasn't gone into the infrastructure to deal
with the climate change that was inevitable because of the industry.
Hold that thought for one.
Okay, so he's going to have to hold that thought because MSNBC wants to break away because they've got video of a helicopter. It's live, man. It's live. It's immediate. It's real. They've got video of a helicopter pulling somebody up out of the floodwaters in a basket. I don't know why they couldn't have continued airing his audio while this stuff came up, but obviously the person being lifted up in a basket took precedence over actually talking about why this problem is the problem that it is. And see, what he was describing there had a special resonance for me. A lot of money has come out of that area, he points out, because of the discovery of oil in 1901. But then he points out that it hasn't come back in terms of infrastructure and disaster preparedness and readiness for... And that is typical of sacrifice zones. That is typical of places that are subject to what is generally referred to as the resource curse. The resources to be extracted are prioritized. Companies come in and extract for all their goddamn well worth. And the way they make money is by taking money out and never putting money back. Those areas by those chemical plants and oil refineries where there are almost incalculable amounts of money made are some of the poorest places in the country. You could not pay an ExxonMobil executive to live within a country league, let alone mile, of one of these installations. Because they're toxic. They're poisonous. As Carol points out, Houston is a perfect example of the free market. Every community was able to create their own little fiefdom, and city planning was ignored. Anyone could build anything they wanted to everywhere. And this is the result. These people were warned and have been warned for a very long time. But the working people, the poor folks, they were just going where the work is. I heard an interview earlier today with a guy who's lived in the same house for 30 years. And his house is ruined. And he's a plumber. Oh, great. He'll be able to replumb his house. Cool. He's probably enough of a handyman, maybe at whatever, 60, 62 years old. Maybe he can rebuild his or repair his house by hand. Because he doesn't have any flood insurance. Something like only 20% of the people in the affected region had flood insurance, and they lived on a flood plain. Because, among other things, flood insurance is brutally expensive. Prohibitively expensive. But we've seen this a million times. I mean, it's how we depopulated rural America. Well, you know, there's work in the city. Go to the city. You know, maybe you live on a farm that your family's lived on for generations, and you can go to the city and live in a Cracker Jack box, but there's work there, which means there's more money there. But of course, what you find out when you get there is while there's more money there, there are more ways to separate you from it, and it costs more to live there. So even though you're making more money, you're paying more money out too. Isn't it beautiful how capitalism works? How the free market works? So they had to cut away from an actual meaningful piece of reporting about why things are the way they are along the Texas Gulf Coast to watch a person be lifted up in a basket by a U.S. Navy helicopter.
1 second, because on the screen we've got a live helicopter rescue. I believe I'm going to ask my control room. This is in Beaumont. Miguel Almaguer, I believe, is on that helicopter. They have lowered the basket to get somebody from the water. This is a Navy helicopter, and it is rescuing someone now. Somebody on the ground is placing someone into the basket, and now we are seeing the basket rise up to the helicopter where that person will be pulled inside. Watch that now. You just saw moments ago two other people rescued by this helicopter. We're sitting inside the helicopter. Here we go. The basket coming up to the edge of the cabin on the helicopter.
Now, I'm going to interrupt that for just a moment to ask a question. What, and I'm not trying to be an asshole here. What is the journalistic value of what you just heard and what people watching TV saw? What is the journalistic value of it? Because having watched this two or three times and asking myself the same question time and again, I can't come up with a satisfactory answer. I cannot come up with any answer that says that there is any journalistic value to interrupting the conveyance of information about why the situation is the way it is in order to show pictures of somebody being lifted up out of a... Okay, if you're related to the person in the basket, then there's journalistic value because you know that your loved one is inside the helicopter now. And as long as the helicopter can land safely, your loved one has been brought to safety. Maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a neighbor. But if that's the case, the journalistic value of it being broadcast by a national news organization, international really, is nominal. Because eventually this rescued person will get to a phone and they'll get a message to whoever's looking for him, and he'll say, "I'm okay, are you okay?" They'll say, you hope that we're okay, we're glad you're okay, praise be to God, okay? And that's about all I can find, unless you just enjoy watching disaster porn. And I'm not saying anybody in this community does. But as Carol Baker says, yeah, good old disaster porn. There is no fucking journalistic value. But something to which the American people are very decidedly unaccustomed, that is journalistic reporting that conveys badly needed information, was interrupted so that Ali Velshi, and I'm not gooning on Ali Velshi, it's his job, and Bill, they're bringing up the basket, and there's a person in the basket, and the basket's swaying a little bit, and the basket's coming up some more, and the basket's getting nearer the helicopter. This is a Navy helicopter. Okay, would the journalistic value of this change if it was an Air Force helicopter or a Coast Guard helicopter? Or how about an oil company helicopter? Because, by the way, you know, all the oil platforms that were in the way of the storm out in the Gulf, those were evacuated toot sweet, baby. So we get this interruption.
People from inside are now pulling it up, and we have somebody in there. We're just going to try and get a better shot of it. Obviously, this is not in our hands. This is a
my God. At this point, I was expecting him to smack the guy and make him cry, so we could say, "Oh, it's a healthy rescuee." Jesus.
Moving helicopter with a rescue taking place. We are looking at a gentleman who's got his belongings in his hand, who has been put inside the helicopter now. A safe rescue above Beaumont. But boy, what a thing. Shihab Ratansi is still with me. He's in Beaumont on the ground, where not too far from where this took place.
So now we're going to try to get back, after we've interrupted him, in the middle of explaining why the disaster is as bad as it is. He's going to try to pick up his train of thought, right? Right, okay.
And Shihab, this is a major point. You are not only in the heart of oil country, you are where right around where the strategic petroleum reserves are. There are refineries there, chemical plants. There's been a lot of this kind of discussion, and yet this is what we're seeing. We're seeing roads that are completely, completely covered, people trapped in their apartments and their dwellings.
You can't make the connection between the oil and gas industry and climate change much clearer. And you know, you were talking to someone in Port Arthur. We understand the largest crude oil refinery in the United States in Port Arthur is shutting down. That might sound very prudent, but what we know from experience is when you shut down these refineries, there's a huge amount of toxic gas that's released. So we've got to watch out for all that. And in the past, oil and gas companies have just got away with covertly just like losing a lot of toxic waste in emergencies like this. But
which is a great point. Hey, don't let a good disaster go to waste. It costs us money to deal with these toxins. Just let it loose in the edit lay oosley in the Udflay Otter way. You know? Right. Carol points out the good news about closing down all the oil platforms is that the oil companies won't lose a fucking dime as fuel prices have spiked 25 cents a gallon here already. Oh, yeah, they spiked here, too, in West Virginia. Because free market, because capitalism. Because oil company executives haven't figured out that they don't hook U-Hauls to hearses yet. And I sympathize with your frustration, Carol. Carol says, I can't get through a fucking sentence without fucking swearing. Well, you're going to swear a little more in a minute. You really are. Because he's pointed out, and again, this reporter's name is Shihab Ratansi. He's pointed out that the oil companies have tried to bury
climate change information that they've known was valid since the 1970s, at the same time that they were funding AstroTurf organizations to spread information directly to the contrary, that they often dump their poisons during these kinds of disasters. What else?
It's not rocket science. This has been warned about for years by climate scientists. ProPublica had a piece just last year warning of that something like this was bound to happen in the Houston area at the very least. And yet this is all coming as a surprise, and it's just, there just aren't the preparations for it. And yet so much money has been generated here. The mayor yesterday talking about how she spent $5 million on roadways for drainage. Well, it wasn't enough. And yet there is more money here. And Texas politicians clearly have a lot to answer for, because they're the ones.
I think we may have just lost Shihab's line there. We're looking at a...
Yeah, you're damn right you did. And he didn't come back. Because he began pointing out things that are very real and very true in the midst of this disaster. Texas politicians have a lot to answer for. But I will extend that, you know, because, hey, like I've said before, this is not a corporate broadcast. This is an independent broadcast. I get to say what I think to be factual. I get to say what I think to be true. And I don't have to worry about offending any oligarchs or anything like that. Or oil companies who might, you know, be advertisers. And the fact of the matter is, Texas politicians have a lot to answer for. Every Republican politician in the United States of America that does not acknowledge the reality of climate change and does not act in accordance with that acknowledgement has a lot to answer for. But I, by God, will not stop there. Every single American who has voted for these people has a lot to answer for. Because every time one of these monster weather disasters strikes somewhere, anywhere in the United States, every voter who voted for an elected representative who denies the reality of climate change has a lot to answer for. Don't they? I'm sitting here, I'm dry, the power's on. I realize that what I have just said may qualify me as an absolute jerk. But God Almighty, if not now, when are we ever going to talk about this? Because, see, in a couple of weeks' time, we'll be bootstrapping the hardball, and there'll be, look, Donald Trump flew to Missouri today to talk about, you want to talk about an asshole? I mean, I'm saying that the people who vote for the people who deny the climate change that make these storms worse, I'm saying they got something to answer for. But that may make me an asshole. But if you want to talk about an asshole, four square, brass bound, how much of an asshole do you have to be to go to Missouri and talk about giving tax cuts to rich people in the middle of a monumental national disaster that is going to, it's going to wipe out FEMA? And by the way, while we're at it, it's probably going to be going to lead, if not to the absolute collapse, then the near collapse of the National Flood Insurance Program. That's not speculation. I'd say that's a 90% certainty. And yeah, Carol, you're right. Not to worry. The poors are disproportionately affected. But Donald Trump, who doesn't pay any goddamn taxes in the first place, needs a tax break. And his buddies need a tax break. And the Koch brothers need a tax break. So he went to Missouri today to talk about tax cuts for rich people while sopping wet people were being hauled out on baskets on helicopters. And while reporters were, well, their connection was just strangely lost when they started talking about who was really responsible for the extent of the damage. Nobody's responsible for the hurricane itself, but the extent to which the hurricane caused massive amounts of damage. You start talking about that, you're going to have a problem, Sunshine. Right? Certainly seems that way to me. If you have any interest in talking about this topic or others, because believe you me, I got others. Well, you know how to reach the program, 304-574-8178, or Skype to Skype from anywhere on the planet, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Well, thank you. Thank you for understanding, Asa. Other than being contractually obligated to be a neoliberal DNC shill, of course, you're free to unleash the scorn on any corporation on this program. Thank you for your understanding. So, if you want to talk, let's talk. We can certainly do that. I'm going to take a break right now and sort of retool. Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Jim pointing out by email. You have a valid point. News? 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 Yeah. John with a note. A people's society and government is only as good as the people themselves. There are too many superstition-soaked, nasty, selfish people to have a decent nation. Yeah, about 33% of the electorate are why we can't have nice things. Like cities that don't flood. In entirely predictable storms. Not just predictable, predicted. It's not like somebody missed the call on this. The warnings have been out there for years, and they're out there for other coastal cities, too. And one of them's going to be next. And you know what? That city's not going to be ready either. Oh, and just to sort of draw the focus away for a minute, had a little news out of the 4th United States Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond today. Here in the county where I live, there are a pair of what are called injection wells. These injection wells are used for the purpose of pumping natural gas drilling filth, fracking poison, into the earth, you know, alongside the water table for the however many thousands of people that live in this area. This is not something that has sat well with people who live here. To their credit, the Fayette County, West Virginia Commission passed an ordinance to ban the disposal of natural gas drilling waste in the county. A United States District Judge named John Copenhaver Jr. Granted a motion from EQT Production Company, a natural gas firm, that some of the ordinance were in violation of the West Virginia Oil and Gas Act and the West Virginia Department of Environmental Permitting, I mean protections, rules about how you do underground injection. Now, this was a while back. This was in June of last year. That ruling was appealed. Well, today, the United States Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said, fuck some hillbillies. It's okay to poison them. The ruling dismissing the ordinance against disposal of fracking poisons in a little West Virginia county in the middle of the tourism area, that ruling will stand. Poison the hillbillies all you want. Because, I mean, after all, they're hillbillies. And just as was the case with something Carol Baker said a minute ago, the poors are disproportionately affected. Because, oh, by the way, there are disease clusters near those injection wells. Carol says, I do have to ask, after the massive tax cuts, who pays to clean up this mess? Not the people who created it. They get the CEO bonuses. Oh, hell, they'll never even get their alligator shoes wet. We all pay. Poor people pay. Poor people who walk away from homes in which they have considerable equity but are now utterly without value, they pay. And yeah, California pays. And Oregon pays. And Washington pays. Minnesota pays. Massachusetts pays. New York pays. New Jersey pays. All those states that never get back nearly as much of their tax dollars that they send to Washington, they pay. While a state like Texas, that takes in far more than it ever pays out to the federal government, they don't pay. The Republican legislators who have ignored climate change's obvious and known impacts on storm activity, they don't pay. The legislators who have rejected city planning or zoning, they don't pay. The list of people who don't pay goes on and on and on. So a little break, then we come back to your calls, conversation. We'll see what's going on. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains, walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways, stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests, been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mother of the graveyard. It's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard. And nobody listening, one person starving.
what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? What'll you do now, my darling, you're wrong. I'm going back out before the rain starts falling. Walk to the depths of the deepest black forest, where the people are many and the hands are all empty. Where hell and some poison are flooding their waters. Where the home in the valley meets the damp dirty prison. Where execution's face is always well hidden. Where hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten. Where black is the color and none is the number. And the hell it damn, think it damn, speak it to breathe it. Then protect it from the mountains so all souls can see it. Then I stand in the ocean until I stop sinking. The look my song well before I stop singing. And it's a heart, it's a heart. And it's a heart. And it's a heart rings a golden fall. And it's a heart. And it's a heart. And it's a heart. And it's a heart rings a golden fall.
It's been a week of pretty easily appropriate bumpers. That, of course, the Roxy Music version of Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. 16 minutes past the hour on this prayer meeting Wednesday edition of The Horn. There is a lot more stuff to go into, and some of it's pretty disgusting. Jerry Falwell's dead. Pat Robertson should be. I mean, you know, just from an actuarial standpoint, and maybe, it could be that Sea of Galilee mud mask just works really, really well to make it look otherwise. We've got the next generation. Gay blaming for natural disasters. I had a note I didn't get to last night that really deserved one of those. When we get around to the story talking about, you know, it's the gays' fault for this whole hurricane thing. This was cowbell-worthy last night. It's still cowbell-worthy, courtesy of Matt in San Francisco. Bob, I've been trying to harness the power of gay for years now. So far, all I've managed to bring into being is a well-decorated house, a sharp-dressed chihuahua, and a great group of people to gather for Sunday brunch. Matt in San Francisco. That's pretty powerful all by itself, but, you know, you really haven't reached the bigs until you can command a hurricane or a volcano or an earthquake or three. So, don't rest upon your laurels, Matt. Because all we got to do is ask a certain class of people, and we know why there's a hurricane hitting Houston. Let's run over and check in with Scott. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
I'm here. I'm happy.
Well, here and happy. That's two good things. You're upright, breathing, and above ground, so that's a couple more goodies.
And they're just piling up.
They sure are. Count your blessings. Name them one by one. You talk about the new generation of haters and greedy people. I'm not sure that many people are aware that Joel Osteen did not just spring up with his the Lakeside basketball court church,
yeah,
in Houston.
Right.
His daddy, John Osteen, had a ministry back in the 60s and 70s, and he took sick and died, even though he was a real big faith healer. Go figure. And Joel, I believe I read, was hesitant to pick up the mantle, but I guess he got with the accountants and saw that there was a shit pot of money to be had. So he kind of...
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah.
Yeah. Well, just like Franklin Graham. Franklin basically was somewhat rebellious against his parents, Billy and Ruth Graham. And he went by the wayside there for a while, but his daddy got older and was doing less and less in terms of ministerial stuff with his evangelistic association. Franklin, again, got with the accountants and saw that big old pile of glorious money, that filthy lucre, brothers and sisters, and said, well, what can I do? You know? And, of course, Jerry Falwell Jr., Jesus. I've been to that church, believe it or not, the old Thomas Road Baptist Church.
Oh, dear God.
Down in Lynchburg, Virginia?
Yes.
Good Lord. What a production. And the only reason I went, this is back in the very early 70s when I was in my Bible-thumping, Jesus-freaking days, and one of the people that I did used to like, who was a minister, who you may recall, I think he's retired now, down in Texas somewhere, was the Reverend Bob Harrington, the chaplain of Bourbon Street. He carried a big red Bible and
oh my wore. God! You know what? I actually heard him preach in person one time. I used to have a Bible now, with his signature in it.
How the hell? Well, so do I. I've got a New Testament with the Psalms in the back, with Bob's signature. And now this is an intriguing story. How the hell did you go manage to have all of the planets and stars align so that you went to watch Bob Harrington preach? Now, I could see if you watched him on Phil Donahue debating with Madeline Murray.
Oh, O'Hare. No. He was on an evangelizing revival tour. And he held a revival right at our church.
Oh, really? Okay.
Hallelujah. Huh.
Hallelujah.
I mean, that's the same Bible that also had the signature of the guy who used to play Ebb on Green Acres, too.
Oh, I can't think of his name, but I know who you mean.
He come to the church and witnessed to us.
Well, I used to see him on the Billy Graham Crusades every now and again. And I think Pat Buttram got up and gave a word of testimony once, which was interesting.
Well, you know, when you get the word of testimony from Mr. Haney.
Well, Mr. Douglas, my two close encounters with Bob Harrington, once was, hell, I was still in high school. It was like 72, I guess. The National Religious Broadcasters Convention over in D.C., I snuck in there one day and got to meet him. And then a couple of years later, I arranged for him to appear on a nightly talk show in D.C., to publicize his crusade visit to the DAR Constitution Hall venue. And at the time I was driving a little, I think it was about a 70 or 71 Chevy Vega, four cylinders and a few windows, and that was about the extent of the car, and an aluminum engine. And I made arrangements to pick him up at DAR Constitution Hall, then drive like a bat out of hell from downtown D.C. to Silver Spring, Maryland, to the plush studios of WWDC, AM and FM, in the suburbs there, so that Reverend Bob could appear on the Fred Fisk nightly radio telephone talk show. And at one point, when we were up against time to get from DAR Constitution Hall all the way up to Silver Spring, and at one time, at a stoplight, after driving like a bat out of hell, Bob turned to me, kind of pale and shaky, and said, "Son, you drive like you're saved," if you remember his voice. that sweet, down-home Alabama, I think he was from, actually, Sweetwater, Alabama.
He was born September 2nd, because I looked it up.
Uh-huh.
He was born September 2nd, 1927, in Coxheath, Alabama. You'll be interested to know, he only passed away on the 4th of July of this year.
Oh, Bob did?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, because I always liked him. I always did. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Well, he was up in his 80s, so he's
going on to... He was 89.
Yeah. Not sure how I got onto Bob Harrington, but how did I... Oh, you were talking about the different... the different new generations of the haters and the greedy folks. And I thought of my one and only visit to Thomas Road Baptist Church to see Brother Bob. Well, I hope wherever he is today, he's still happy and, you know, thumping people
with
that Bible.
Well, not to ruin anything for you, but...
Oh, no.
he's not anything. He's dead.
Oh, I know. Well, even the Bible says, I believe in Proverbs, the dead know nothing. Which makes me wonder if we've got a lot of people in charge.
I've been to a lot of concerts where I could probably agree with that, dude.
No, I'm not talking about the Grateful Dead. I'm talking about, if the Bible says the dead know nothing, referring to expired people, I've got to wonder if we've got a shitload of people in charge today who are the walking dead, because they appear to know nothing, even less than nothing.
Well, for those who don't know him, stand by.
All right.
My name is Bob Harrington, and I find it's fun being saved. I like to talk about the Lord, like to share people with the Lord, like to lift up the Lord. He said, if I do, he'll draw all the people to the Father. So it's fun being saved.
And that, of course, was his signature line. It's fun being saved.
And that was obviously done more recently, because when he was in his prime, he could do some fire and brimstone preaching.
He did, but like the best of them, he could also, he was very, very good at making you laugh.
Yeah.
You tended not to walk out of one of his revival meetings so much shaken for the fears of hell, but inspired to go forth and have fun being saved. Now, I think we may argue that some of this was taken entirely, entirely too literally. Say by the modern generation of evangelicals who have a whole lot of fun being saved and do it in ways that generally run contrary to the laws of civilized society.
Well, my take, having met him a couple of times and listening to him and reading things that he had written, and just my spidey sense when it comes to, you know, discernment with people, I seem to detect in him, even though he might have been politically and religiously conservative, and even though he might have towed that theological line, there was a little aspect of him that was very warm and I think sincere and even loving. And, you know, I mean, to get out and one of the most treacherous places for a minister to be preaching and evangelizing has got to be Bourbon Street. I've never been down there, but I've heard tell, you know. And, you know, I hats off to I wish you hadn't told me he had passed on, because I like to think that I'd like to be in a world which still includes old Brother Bob, because he always struck me as sweet.
You know, Scott. There are things that abide, and then there are things that abide. And I can tell you that in that clip of him, he was wearing crimson pants and a white shirt with the scarlet letter A over the left breast. He apparently died a Christian, but he also, more importantly, died a Crimson Tide fan.
Oh, okay.
And well, I've got something you might find interesting here. This is courtesy of Brother Deacon Asa.
Okay.
Joel Osteen's entire hustle really caught on when his wife, Victoria, saw an opportunity in it. Yes, he was the son of a preacher, but he wasn't keen on running his own hustle. See, Victoria Osteen is an Alabama girl, born and raised in your neck of the woods. Yes, about 72 miles east of my neck of the woods. Her dad was a rocket scientist in Rocket City, Huntsville, until he decided NASA money was peanuts compared to the kind of cabbage he could muster up from peddling religion. So he packed up the family and moved out west from Alabama to Tejas. Victoria met homeboy Joel at the tender age of 16, and the rest is history. Brother Deacon Asa adds, I know a thing or two about the Osteen hustle because, one, I occasionally listen to the horse shit he shovels, and, two, I'd like to shovel my own horse shit for that sweet moolah one day. Well, you know, Asa, we need to talk. I don't think you've got enough of a larcenous spirit, but it's entirely possible that you may have an angle that would go over like baked beans at a dinner on the ground. I mean something. Yes, indeed. So
what was Victoria's daddy's name if he would got into the ministry? Because I've probably heard of him.
Okay. Well, we can find that out.
All right.
Probably won't even have to wait on.
Well, probably if you Google her.
We won't even have to wait on Asa. Let's see. She's on Twitter at Victoria Osteen.
Yeah.
She is the Donald Iloff.
No,
Donald
I don't know.
Iloff.
I don't know that name.
She grew up and lived near the Marshall Space Flight Center. Her daddy was a mathematician with General Electric, member of GE's Saturn rocket project, led by Werner von Braun. And they moved when she was two to Houston, Texas, when her daddy got a job with NASA. And she grew up in a southern suburb of Houston. But, yeah, her daddy was Donald Iloff. And when she was 16, she met sweet young Joel. And apparently she is hell among the yearlings with flight attendants.
Well, the few times that I've seen his TV show, I don't believe, and it's only been a few times, but I don't believe I've ever seen him crack a Bible to the extent that he would engage in any exegesis. Or deep.
No. He's a pop psychologist, and
well, yeah, that's what I mean.
And most of the really good ones are.
Yeah.
They lean heavily on the pop psychology, and they really do rather eschew delving deeply into the word "Oh God."
Yeah, like Schuller, Robert Schuller, and his Crystal Church.
Right,
because that'll
get you in trouble.
And he was another one with flight attendants. You might have remembered that incident maybe 8 or 10 years ago where he got into a bit of a scuffle on a plane. And I forget the circumstances, but he was not happy with how he was being treated because he's Robert Schuller, for Christ's sake. You know?
Yeah.
Jeez.
And by the way, Joel Osteen's personal worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 million. And of course, since we're talking about these things, Ron and Raleigh asks, how about my favorite religious grifter, Reverend Dr. Gene Scott?
Oh, well, Gene was a piece of work. I remember Gene Scott. Mercy. He'd sit there smoking a cigar, and he was only on in the dead of night, at least back east. And he'd play this song, I think it was like, Don't Be a Pissant for Jesus, or some such. And I never could get a fix on what his theology was, because he struck me as being rather hedonistic in some regards. I mean, he wasn't your typical Baptist. Let's just put it that way. Hard-shelled, deep-fried Southern Baptist at that.
Well, Lord. Well, I think I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to run on, and because I want to get to some of this next-generation nastiness.
Well, before I go, just let me toss in a quick thought.
Okay.
Earlier, you were talking about the massive devastation in Texas and maybe soon to be Louisiana, and the fact that FEMA is going broke, the flood insurance program will probably go belly up. It doesn't seem like Congress can decide on what to order for lunch, much less rework the tax system in this country. Where does that money come for those programs, those recovery and aid programs? It comes from tax revenue. And what did Trump do today? He did everything except, well, he basically said the taxes are too high as it is. Well, I sent you something a little while ago, and if you see fit, it's brief. Go ahead and read it. It's my response to Trump's little talk earlier today about tax reform and reorganizing the tax system and lowering them further. Because that's the exact wrong thing that we need to be doing. We need to be doing fair across the board business and rich people taxation at a decent level to bring in revenues to get handled the shit that has been sitting, getting worse
the stuff
by
that's
the
been
decade.
Yeah, the stuff that's been left to hang fire.
Yeah, since the days of Reagan when all of this crap really got full tilt boogie. So, you know, in a spare moment or something, read that. If you want to share it, go ahead. But it nails basically why Trump's approach is
right.
So
and you know my dirty little habit in the morning.
Oh yes, I know. You watching your Joe and Mika.
And of course, even with a disaster unfolding in Houston, you know, decency does not, you know, there's no honor among thieves and no decency among PACs and dark money groups. So the ads are still running there on Morning Joe talking about how we need tax reform.
Sure.
In the middle of a humongous disaster that has the potential to strain us to the breaking point. You know, if they were decent, they would pull their ads, you know, for a week or two. They bought a shit ton of them. They run every morning.
Well, it's like when an airliner crashes and there's massive loss of life. Let's say it's the XYZ airline. All airlines pull their advertisements for a period of time simply because they don't want their ad in the next morning's paper being on the display page next to a picture of a fuselage in a swamp and bodies floating around on the surface, you know? But then again, we are dealing with special interests, PACs, and dark money groups, so decency doesn't really enter into the equation, you know. But anyway, and the thing you mentioned last night was spot on as far as these old, ancient 1930s era FDR levies that were put up back then 80 years ago to protect Houston, which could be failing most any time now. All that stuff should have been attended to. It's like maintaining your
car.
Well,
it wasn't, yeah, right. It wasn't one and done, Scott.
No, it's like you build them, but as technology comes about, you improve them. And don't be, I was only at Houston once back in the very early 80s, and I have never seen such urban sprawl in my life. I've never seen the like of it. There was no end to the highways, the overpasses, the underpasses. There seemed like there were two or three, maybe even four, various forms of city center for Houston. And this was 30-some years ago. God only knows what kind of sprawl has taken place since then. And if you dig up all the marsh and the swamp and the ground and the open space, that water will do nothing but run across the concrete and sooner or later collect at some lower level where people are, and then that's when the trouble starts. And we're not going to wish our way out of it. That's my point. We've got to not only do what needs getting done, but we've got to catch up on all those projects that have lain fallow for 30, 35 years. So I'll get off it now, but that's that. People need to take that to heart.
But the maggots need to understand that they are not going to get any meaningful infrastructure improvement out of this administration, because everything is just a cheap grift. Everything's just a dirty little hustle to try to make money either for a Trump or a friend of a Trump or a relative of a Trump or a crony of a Trump or a creditor of a Trump.
Yeah. And it's like you can go to probably go to parts of the New Orleans area and see vivid signs of devastation from Katrina, which was what, 10, 15 years ago, 10 years ago? And even further back, the 14th Street corridor in D.C., which got the hell burned out of it in April of 68 in the wake of the assassination of Dr. King, it's only been comparatively recently, like in the last 10 or 12 years, that any meaningful rebuilding in the upper 14th Street corridor of D.C., 10 blocks from the White House, has been undertaken. And the worst part, it's like the fart that comes after the big dump, is the insult after the injury, is the fact that they're gentrifying these areas so that folks who might have been there when the destruction occurred, they're long gone and they have no chance of ever coming back to their old place. And that's what I predict.
That's some of what will happen within the sprawl that's Houston. You're right. It's hard to identify a Houston. Okay, I mean it's a blob. It's a blob on the coast. But there will be areas where poor people have been especially hard hit, and those places will eventually be gentrified, and the right kind of people will then move in.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like,
the original sin of the United States is racism and slavery.
And I would say the massacre and marginalizing massively of the Native Americans, those three things.
And so it is unrealistic to think that in whatever passes for a recovery for Harvey, that there will not be a racist component there, too.
Right. Because recovery is there to benefit the people who engage in the business activity of so-called recovery, only it shows up as gentrification and marginalizing the most vulnerable people, in my view. So, well, anyway, thanks for letting me share that. And it was fun reminiscing about you with Brother Bob Harrington.
I had forgotten completely about him. And I had forgotten about it's fun to be saved.
It's fun being saved. I think I've got that album, that LP, around here somewhere.
Because there was vinyl. Yes, there was vinyl.
Yes,
it was
indeed.
On sale in the vestibule right next to the bowl of desiccated butter mints.
Right. Well, the little card table with the books and the pamphlets and the music records and the speaking records. That's, hey, look, you take it anyway, you can grab it, you know? I wouldn't be surprised if at the Lakewood Church, Victoria sits there at the table after Sunday service.
Oh, she's co-pastor. And she's well up above that shit.
Oh, well, that's too bad. All right.
All right. One thing before you go, because you're going to want, yes, because neither of us could remember his name.
Yeah.
The guy who played Ebb on Green Acres was Tom Lester.
Tom Lester, of course. Of course.
I didn't want you having to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning going, Tom Lester.
Yeah, well, I knew that I knew it. It's just that, you know, it's like the guy who played Mr. Ziffel, one of the great character actors, Hank Patterson was his name. Since I've been looking at some of these sub-channels on TV, over-the-air TV, with old reruns of 60-year-old comedies and drama shows, he shows up every now and again. You know, like on 77 Sunset Strip and just all those old shows. And I love those old character actors. But anyway, Tom Lester, I will write that.
And he is now 78 years old. And he is from Laurel, Mississippi.
Yeah, I think I remember he was from way, way down there. Well, I'll write his name in my little New Testament right next to Brother Bob's name. And I believe he wrote Bob Harrington Saved 1957 in a red Sharpie.
If I could find that Bible, something similar is in there. It was It was a Living Bible. Remember the Living Bible?
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Yep, it's got Tom Lester's autograph and Bob Harrington's in it, too.
My Lord.
Mm-hmm.
You're living right, Bob. You'll get an extra cup of rice pudding in the great beyond.
I love me some rice pudding.
Well, there you go.
And Tom Lester is the last remaining surviving primary cast member of Green Acres.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah.
All right. I'll let you go, and you take care. Stay cool if you can. It's 92 degrees here, so.
Oh, it's a pleasant 76 here in the fabulous Horn Studios, so I think we're in pretty good shape. Autumn is well on its way to Appalachia. The goldenrods are blooming, and people are sneezing, and right.
Well, send me a bus ticket. Oh, by the way, I know we're not doing fundraising today. I have to rework a couple of budgetary things unexpectedly. The Horn is at the tip-top of my list for 10:01 Thursday night when I get my Social Security funds. And I'm sorry I couldn't help you for August, but we've got you covered in September.
All right. Well, I just want to make sure that we don't do any of that this evening. So promise is a promise.
Okay. I'm sorry I said it. It's just between you and me.
Yeah, right. You weren't on air at the moment.
Yeah, between you, me, and Punky.
And the world. Later, right. Scott.
See you, Bob.
Bye now. Scott and his controller, Punky, calling from San Diego. 14 minutes before the hour. I said I wanted to get to some of this for prayer meeting Wednesday because, you know, we're sitting here talking about real issues related to what's happening on the Texas Gulf Coast and what's moving inland. Be a lot of rain. Hopefully it won't spawn any more horrors. Earther with an observation a couple of minutes ago. I don't understand, emotionally speaking, how anybody believes what Trump peddles. The idea that he can deliver anything good for the country is ridiculous. He's a walking Nigerian email scam. Oh, that's perfect. Wait a minute. Little jingle for that, Arthur. One would think it's so obvious, but it's not a matter of, you know, it's not a matter so much of people believing him. It's that he even if it's not real, they want to believe this stuff. And so, for all intents and purposes, he's the one sitting there. No, really. There's a Santa Claus. I promise. I know him. He's only the best Santa Claus. He's totally real. That's why. And there is an urge all across this country to give money to help with the recovery from Harvey. And it is a noble urge. Might want to be careful about giving to the Red Cross or any of these big religious hucksters like Joel Osteen or God knows Samaritan's Purse there that's run by Franklin Graham. A number of different journalism outlets have run cautionary tales about the American Red Cross. But there are groups that are worthy. But for instance, the American Red Cross claimed it had provided housing for 130,000 people in Haiti after the earthquake there in 2010. The American Red Cross built 6 houses. It didn't do well in Katrina. It didn't do well after Sandy. And cannot really be counted on to do well in this instance. There are some groups, the Center for Disaster Philanthropy, the Greater Houston Community Foundation, Feeding Texas, the Texas Diaper Bank, Austin Pets Alive, all of those can use help. And you know, those are at least legit and worthy. Steve from Georgistan asking, how about the Salvation Army? To the best of my knowledge, the Salvation Army has never stepped back from their evangelical fundamentalist stance on gay and transgendered people. So no. Now, if they have, let me know, and I'll certainly retract. But no. So, like I said, I wanted to, this being prayer meeting Wednesday, I wanted to make sure that we covered just how nasty these evangelical Christians can be. You remember Coach Dave Daubenmeyer, who doesn't coach anybody? This is the guy who had a fit a couple of months back, thanking Jesus for the fact that his softball playing daughters were not lesbians because they didn't have short hair and big butts. Yeah. Well, Dave Daubenmeyer knows whose fault Hurricane Harvey is.
I don't know for sure, but Houston, we got a problem here, and could some of the problems be a result of the judgment of God coming your way because of the slaughter of unborn children? You had a lesbian mayor who wanted to look at the prayers of pastors in their churches. What? It's a debaucherous. People tell me that Houston, Texas is one of the darkest cities in America. Isn't it amazing? Katrina slammed New Orleans. We know about voodoo and the darkness in New Orleans.
Darkness in New Orleans and Houston. I wonder what he could possibly mean by darkness in New Orleans and Houston. Darkness. It can't be coincidence. I mean, you got Katrina in New Orleans and Rita and Ike and Ivan and Frederick and Hugo and now Harvey. All there on the Gulf Coast where there's so much darkness. Right. Of course, the fact that hurricanes tend to develop in the Gulf of Mexico, this is beyond the this is beyond the ken of Coach Dave Daubenmeyer. What? A juniper bush gave forth juniper berries? Really? Darkness. I mean, you go talking about darkness in New Orleans and Houston. I can't be held responsible. I can't help it. I mean, it's going to take me places. But not that place. Get to it. There we go.
You trying to get crazy with this, eh? Don't you know I'm loco?
Gargoyles! Psychics! Dork Satan!
What?
Dork Satan!
That's right. Gargoyles, psychics, dark-sided. Darkness in Houston. That was probably not a reference to the lesbian mayor, but the current mayor.
Now moved right down the coast to Houston, Texas, which isn't far away. 5 hours right down along the Gulf of Mexico. Boom, here it comes. Now it's underwater. Water is a sign of judgment and cleansing. And at this time, is now not the time for the voice of the church to rise up and declare, let's stop killing the babies. Now, I'm taking you on a different angle, and I don't want this to appear to be judgmental, but it can't. I don't know what else to do.
How about not believing in a God who punishes innocent people for the sins that you perceive? I mean, you could do that, Dave, but, well, there's no money in that now, is there? So, I mean, this is Christianity, okay? And I'm sorry if it irks you when I say this is Christianity, but again, I refer you to the things that you have to believe to get your little harp and your harp and your halo or beanie or whatever and your rice pudding in the afterlife. He believes the same thing that everybody else believes that's necessary to make sure that, you know, you don't just turn into worm food when you're dead. Or particulate matter in the atmosphere, as the case may be.
I don't know what else to do.
So, I mean, you know, God's out there killing people who didn't have abortions because there are abortions. God's out there killing straight people because there was a lesbian mayor. I'm just going to ask you simply, would you want anything to do with that God? If it's the only God in the universe, would you want anything to do with a God that behaves that way? You wouldn't let some human being that behaved that way across your threshold into your home. Yeah. Asa, I'm not. If not a hurricane, it'll be something else. Asa says, I'm willing to bet a few minutes into the tirade, Coach Daubenmeyer will predict the next hurricane to hit Detroit. You know, what with all the darkness and everything. Darkness. Dork-sided. Yeah. Dork-sided. But that's not all. There's actually worse. And this isn't with specificity toward the hurricane. This is just another case of the inability of these evangelical bastards to tell the difference between their own paranoia and, you know, a genocide. Remember Matt Staver? Matt Staver heads up the entirely tax-free Liberty Council hustle. This is the pettifogging group that, among others, defended Sister Clerk Kim Davis when she was trying to protect Round County, Kentucky, from being overrun by hordes of married lesbians. Well, Liberty Council is, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is pretty much a clearinghouse and does a hell of a lot of hard work to make sure that they get stuff right. They're a clearinghouse for figuring out who and where the hate groups are. Matt Staver is the head of Liberty Council, and Liberty Council is, in fact, listed as a hate group. Because the only thing they do is advance the legal causes, I won't even say rights, but the legal causes of groups that engage in hate. In this case, hate for the LGBTQQQ community. And of course, it's great for fundraising when Matt Staver can claim that he's being persecuted, as of course all of the precious little upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexuals are?
A deep breath, step back, let's pray for healing in this country, but let's have civil discourse, and let's not label to the point of hate groups like this SPLC is doing, people with whom you just simply disagree. They know that these organizations like FRC, Liberty Council, AFA, ADF, they know that they are not violent organizations.
And the SPLC didn't say they were violent organizations. They said they're a hate group because they foster hate. Because there's no love involved in trying to keep two people who want to spend their lives together from getting married. There's no love involved in trying to deny essential constitutional rights to entire groups of people in this country. There's hate.
They know that they're Christian organizations, and they know that they oppose any kind of hatred or violence. They just don't agree with us on the issue of marriage. Now, look, from millennia of human history until now and all over the world, the issue of male and female has been something that has transcended time, geography, and political infrastructures. It is what it is. Marriage is what it has been throughout our history. And
except it sort of hasn't. I mean, this guy actually went to law school. This guy graduated from law school. This guy has a law degree. This guy practices law. Somewhere along the way, he had to have been exposed, if nothing else, in his bachelor's, his undergrad work, to the idea that there are multiple cultures all around this sweet little blue-green marble time machine hurtling through space. Marriage is not, and has not been, always the same thing. Male and female have not always been viewed in the same light. You can't say that you view a female the same in a culture where she has to go around, where a woman has to go around in a goddamn beekeeper suit to keep from being stoned to death. You can't say that that culture views a female as in the same way as a culture that views a female as a fully autonomous, functioning, self-actualizing person who goes and does as she pleases within the society based upon the talents that she has and develops and the education, et cetera, et cetera. You cannot say that those are, you know, just both the same kind of female. Unless, of course, you want to reduce every human being on this planet to nothing more than a life support system for reproductive organs, which is, in fact, exactly what these hateful freaks do, which is kind of an epitome of hate. When you refuse to see the individuality, when you refuse to see that which makes people special and see them as nothing more than plumbing, that's just mean and nasty.
Certainly, biblically, we know what marriage is.
Oh, biblically, we know what marriage is, do we? God almighty, do we have to go through with this all over again? We're not gonna. One night a long time ago, we calculated how many wives David had and how many wives Saul had. And, you know, there are different, even within the Bible itself, there are different descriptions of what it takes to be married. You know, you go there in Genesis, and it's pretty much strictly an arm's-length contractual obligation, a transaction in which you swap a fertile female for any number of barnyard livestock. Because they are essentially, in that transaction, being deemed to be of identical value. They are fungible. A female is a liquid asset just like a camel. Now, later on, you get considerably different kinds of marriage. You get political arrangements, things like that, in the idea of kingship.
And then there's, oh, don't go read it now, but save it for later when you've got an empty stomach. Genesis 38. Yeah, go read it, preferably in the King James Version, but pick your version if you wish. Different ideas about, marriage. I mean, can you imagine living in a world where, let's say, you've got a sibling, you've got a brother. I'm talking to the guys here. And sadly, your brother dies unexpectedly and does so without having ever impregnated his wife. Now, maybe, you're in college, or maybe you're in the military, or off seeking your fortune somewhere. Well, in that particular version of marriage, you, by God, have to drop everything, go home, and marry your brother's wife. And you have to bang her like a cheap gong. And you have to work at it until you have knocked up your brother's wife. And then when the baby is born, they don't say, and let's say it's Bill and Ted. Ted died. They don't say, look, here's Bill's new baby boy. They say, look, Susie has just given birth to Ted's new son. So even though you're doing all the work, you're doing all the supporting, you're maintaining the household, it's not even deemed to be your kid within the eyes of the law. And if it should happen that you're kind of grossed out by the whole prospect, and she doesn't necessarily want you a rutting on her like Mayella, and you don't feel too good about rutting on her like Mayella, and you just kind of wander off and rub one out, well, God will kill you dead. Because what I just told you is the Genesis 38 story of Onan, which is why for years and years and years and years and years and years, masturbation was referred to as onanism. Really? So when this guy says, marriage has always been the same in the Bible, he's even lying about his own holy book, which within the framework of the religion in which he participates means that God is probably going to let angels sodomize him when he dies. Because he's not just lying about the world at large, he's lying about what do the evangelicals consider the Bible to be? The literal, inerrant word of God. That is a major sin within that religious framework.
To continue to share that view that's supported by the Bible and supported by the natural created order is no reason to lump somebody in a hate group. Look.
No, the hateful behavior is. Because the SPLC didn't do what he just said. The SPLC lumps them in a hate group because, they're hateful. These people actually believe if they could get away with it, these people would stone gay people to death. All right, let's be clear. And by the way, little cowbell for Brother Deacon Hasa. How many Philistine foreskins is Matt Staver's wife worth on the open market these days? I'm asking for a friend. Well, I haven't checked the Philistine foreskins the futures market there on the Board of Trade, but he's pretty wealthy, so I'm sure he's not gonna sell her for cheap. That's gonna take a lot of foreskins.
We have friends in all different kinds of different lifestyles and behaviors and different colors of their skin and so forth. We don't hate anybody. We have our biblical values that
we just want to impose what our God tells us we have to do. We want to impose that on people who don't believe in our God. That's all. In other words, we'd like to establish, if you don't mind, a theocracy, thank you very much. See Stoning, Supra. Right? Yeah.
Here too. But we do that without any hatred at all. We hate no one. I mean, it would be completely contrary. I would shut Liberty Council down in a heartbeat if it really was a hate organization. If we really harbored hate in our hearts, because it would be contrary to the Lord Jesus Christ whom we serve. Mm-hmm. It'd be contrary to his life and his teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, so is everything you do with your entire lives, but that hasn't stopped you running this little pettifogging lawyer gospel hustle.
And you know, Matt, if I saw an article at lifenews.com that saying if we really want to stop white supremacy, we should start with the 266 black babies that are killed every day by Planned Parenthood.
Well, talk about white supremacy.
It gets so tiresome. But what about the Negro babies we don't really care about? Because I have never seen Matt Staver or read a story of or heard anything of Matt Staver walking the halls of Congress demanding that say, food stamp support or medical support or any kind of post-birth support for babies, black, white, or otherwise, who are poor, be paid greater attention to by the Republican majority with whom he is aligned. Never, not once, ever.
Exactly what Margaret Sanger was all about. She wanted to ultimately create a super race. She was a social Darwinianist. And she wanted to eliminate certain populations, including the black population. And that's why she put her then contraception, later abortion clinics, into these minority neighborhoods to stop the reproduction of these minority communities, particularly the African-American community.
How far is this going to go? Is a better question, how far are we going to let this go as a nation collectively?
Well, you know, I think...
You might want to get the hockey puck. I mean, not because this is going to be crazy, because this is going to make you very angry. You know, especially if, like, you're Jewish.
That's a really good question. I think that's a question that everyone listening here needs to answer. How far are you going to let this go? I mean, I think we've crossed the line, and we can't let this go any further. We've got to push back. It cannot happen like this. You know, if you go back into the 1930s, what ultimately happened back then with the Jews, and history, I mean, there's other histories that you could point to, but they began to ultimately ban Jews from public employment, then ban Jews from their private employment, then put a Star of David on their ID and a Star of David on their passport, restrict their travel, restrict their income opportunity. And eventually, you know what happened, history tells mm-hmm. us. We had to fight a World War II over that issue. Everyone needs to just take a deep breath, step back. Let's pray for healing in this country, but let's have civil discourse, and let's not label to the point of...
Oh, shut up. That's right. The Southern Poverty Law Center identifying Liberty Council and their tax-free hustler Matt Staver as a hate group is exactly the same as being a Jew in Nazi Germany. So, therefore, the SPLC are Nazis? All right, then. Up's down, left is right, light is dark, cold is hot. I mean, it's going to be kind of, I mean, not going to be able to tell you're Nazis without a program. But this is, of course, a typical tactic. When oppressors, and he is certainly an oppressor, begins to receive pushback, they start crying out, "Lord, Lord," that they are the ones who are being oppressed. Later on in another clip that I won't bother you with, he goes on to say that being labeled a hate group, which, of course, the Liberty Council is like a civil war against our values. These dumb bastards cannot resist the civil war ideology. They can't resist the comparison. And in point of fact, it was said outright by none other than bucket pudding salesman Jim Baker. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Hill had an article reporting on this old fraud, speaking to his Prophecy and End Time news program, and it's all tax-free. Hallelujah. If impeachment happens, there will be a civil war in the United States of America. The Christians will finally come out of the shadows, because we are going to be shut up permanently if we're not careful. Where are these shadows of which he speaks? Anybody? Bueller? Yeah. Not so much in the shadows, as far as I can tell. You know, when we provide them with special tax-free status that allows them to scream their hatred from the rooftops with no interference from the government or anybody else. When we allow them to, you know, sell bucket pudding and do it tax-free, it's kind of hard to see where they're being persecuted. But the important part of this is that he is giving to some certain portion of the American religious public, he is providing a certain amount of indulgence, if you will, for Christians to start taking pot shots at people with whom they disagree. And that, by God, is kind of scary. Who am I kidding? It's really scary. Because sooner or later, somebody's going to take them up on it. Do you remember back before the Republican convention? About a year ago? Remember when Roger Stone said, if the Republicans try to keep Donald Trump from being nominated, that his supporters would resort to physical violence? And thereafter, delegates to the Republican convention were targeted with threats of physical violence. Well, Jim Baker isn't the only one waving the Civil War flag. Roger Stone is, too. you will have a spasm of violence in this country, an insurrection like you've never seen. The people will not stand for impeachment. A politician that votes for it will endanger their own life. There will be violence on both sides. I'll make this clear. I'm not advocating violence, but I'm predicting it. Oh, okay, you're not advocating it. An insurrection. If Donald Trump is impeached. An insurrection. If, and of course the Republicans will never do it, an insurrection if people who swore an oath not to a man but to the Constitution itself actually take their constitutional duties seriously and move to remove a man from office who should never have been in there in the first place. Insurrection. Is it just me, or do you find this talk a little bit unsettling? Remember, when Roger Stone says this, he's got the ability to carry through. This is the guy who organized the Brooks Brothers riot in South Florida in 2000 that went a long way toward making George W. Bush the president of the United States, even though he never should have. Never should have been. This then, is the world we live in. And I suggest that when the right wing starts talking about wanting things like insurrections and civil wars, I suggest you take them seriously. They're not kidding. I mean, Jesus Christ, in regard to the monuments controversy, a Republican in Georgia warned a former member of the Georgia legislature that she was liable to be lynched if she persisted in her effort to see memorials to vicious racists taken down. We're talking about Georgia State Representative Jason Spencer, a Republican, and LaDawn Jones, a former Democratic member of the Georgia legislature. Ms. Jones started questioning whether or not state tax dollars were being used to pay for the upkeep of a memorial to, of all people, Jefferson goddamn Davis. I mean, if there is one Confederate who doesn't deserve a memorial anywhere, it's the guy who led their fucking government. But there's a Jefferson Davis Memorial in Kentucky because he was born there. There's a Jefferson Davis Memorial in Georgia because he took it on the lam there. There's a Jefferson Davis Memorial in Mississippi because that is where he had his slave-supported plantation. You get the idea. So when LaDawn Jones asked about whether state tax monies were paying for the upkeep of a memorial to Jefferson Davis, this fine, upstanding American, State Representative Jason Spencer of Georgia, said, "Continue your quixotic journey into South Georgia, and it will not be pleasant. the truth, not a warning. Those folks won't put up with it like they do in Atlanta. I can guarantee you, you won't be met with torches, but something a lot more definitive. Then he went on to say, they'll go missing in the Okefenokee. Too many necks, they are red around here. Don't say I didn't warn you about them. And maybe if you're not African-American, maybe that doesn't sound too specific. But people with a long history of knowing exactly what Klansmen and white supremacists do know exactly what kind of warning that is. Matt in San Francisco, subject line, these fucks. There's nothing like listening to a bunch of hateful religious freaks talk about how they don't harbor any hate in their heart. I'd like to see them at the funerals of gay and transgender people murdered by stupid fucks that are motivated by their hate-filled radio shows and sermons. Of course, Matt, you never will. Because they don't have the decency or the shame to show up. And you know what's even sadder? They'd probably be forgiven. Meanwhile, Mike in Cascadia just sent along a story. This is bizarre, or not, because America. Rock climbers at Little Cottonwood Canyon in Utah. Have recounted being shot at. Really? This was yesterday. Brandon Wild and Nate Lamb were climbing about 250 feet up a pitch when they heard gunshots in the distance. And then said, we heard bullets whizzing by us. I mean, bullets were to the left, to the right of me, below me, above me. Nate Lamb said, it was kind of surreal, you know. I was kind of in denial that it was even happening. This country. Mike Noel was recently speaking derisively of rock lickers. You know, that's kind of like tree huggers. So as Mike in Cascadia asks, were those shots inspired by Noel's rhetoric? Orrin Hatch, Mike points out, has used the same kind of rhetoric. Congressman Rob Bishop, the same. And it all ties, you know, when these right-wingers start talking, start using eliminationist language, how is it in any form a surprise when people act on it, thinking they are acting in accordance with it?
That's just one of them rock lickers.
Oh, that person's no longer human. It's okay to squeeze off a few rounds at them. There are little moments of justice, though. There's a restaurant out in the Bay Area called Omei, O apostrophe M-E-I. It's a Chinese restaurant. Curiously, it's run by a guy named Roger Grigsby. In the aftermath of Charlottesville, the San Francisco Bay Area Independent Media Center decided to start looking through election records, and they found 8 people in the Bay Area who had given money to the campaign of former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke when he ran for Congress. He ran for U.S. Senate last year in Louisiana. And they found a $500 donation by a guy named Roger Grigsby of Santa Cruz to David Duke's U.S. Senate campaign. Readers of the newspaper then declared that there should be a boycott of his restaurant, Omei. And next thing you know, a sign's up in the restaurant window. Loyal Omei patrons, Omei has come under attack. Nobody was shooting bullets at them. Slanderous and malicious internet rumors concerning this business, its owner and staff have forced us to close for now. We will let you know when we plan to return to providing you with what many consider to be the best Chinese food in the area. Thanks for the last 38 years. Slanderous and malicious internet rumors. Looks to me like a $500 verified campaign contribution doesn't qualify as a rumor now, does it? Neither is it slanderous or libelous because, of course, within American jurisprudence, the truth is an absolute defense. They're slandering me. Well, you gave the Grand Dragon... You gave the Imperial Wizard $500 for his Senate campaign, didn't you? Well, yeah. I rest my case. So then, because he doesn't know the first law of holes, this Grigsby guy writes an email to KPIX-TV in which he says the following. We are just a token in a much larger process of terrorizing white European Americans into silence in what has come to be known as the War on Whites. My campaign contribution was to one of the men supporting European American civil rights. It is unclear if or when the restaurant will reopen. Raj? Buddy? No, not really. Wouldn't call you buddy. I think you're, well, I mean, you know, I mean, Raj?
You dick!
You just admitted to being a goddamn Klansman. You didn't say you were an exalted Cyclops or a noble Kleagle or any of that shit, but you started talking about how you support European-American civil rights and how white European Americans are being terrorized into silence, and how there's a war on whites. Guess what, Raj? You win a free pointy hat, and I don't mean a dunce cap. Another person who the newspaper noted was a David Duke supporter, said, because you can't, you know, it's just, it's bait, okay? They respond to the bait. It's like the fly hanging above the river. The trout can't help it. In this era of communism, as the noose is tightening around our necks, really, a Klansman's going to talk about nooses. William Hubble made this statement. In this era of communism, as the noose is tightening around our necks, we may be rounded up and shot in the back of the head. I declined to comment about my contribution to David Duke. I'm not a member of the KKK, but I sure as hell am not a member of the Black Lives Matter movement either! Because that's part, that's another part of it. You know, because it, there's different side, the sides of the same coin. Yeah. 25 minutes left in the program. Let's run over and talk to John in Central PA. Hey, John.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
Oh, good. How you doing, man?
You know, I'm here.
Nice. I actually just got, I was just in a church a couple of minutes ago. A friend of mine plays in a church band, and she wanted me to, you know, to watch her play and everything, for, you know, watch her band practice and stuff tonight. So I thought, you know, I'll do it. So, I, you know, I had to participate in some praying.
do you feel any different? Is it fun being, is it fun being saved?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm having even more impure thoughts. But, yeah, I didn't want to be rude, so I didn't want to be like, okay, I'm not really into that or anything, you know. But I just figured, you know what, hey, it might even be fun. So I participated in the prayer part. But, yeah, I wanted to call to clarify a couple of things I said the other night. Like, I wanted to respond to Michael because I definitely welcome – push back because I, you know, part of this process is getting our thoughts organized, you know, and to kind of give each other's thoughts or on different subjects and things when it comes to this, you know, awful political climate that we're in. And with regard to the Russia stuff and when I was saying that about the, I said there was no, what did I say? Did I say there was no there, or I said something about...
No, you said Mueller doesn't have, appears Mueller doesn't have shit.
Oh, yeah. Well, really what I meant by that, look, I think that Trump is actually...
Well, and understand, Michael was not gooning on you, okay?
Okay,
so just as long as we're clear on that.
Yeah, no, I didn't take no offense or anything like that. I welcome this kind of discussion, you know, that's what you have this operation going for. And it's working because it got me to thinking. And well, first of all, I want to put it out there that I think Trump is guilty of much, much worse than anything that this Mueller guy could even begin to investigate. And but the thing is, I don't want people to be disappointed, man, because we people on our side, not people on, well, generally collectively, people on our side, we'll hype something up like, oh, this isn't going to happen or that's going to happen. Or then when it does, like, for example, they'll say, oh, Trump has a big speech tonight. Oh, he's going to say this. He's going to start babbling like a little kid or something, or he's going to be, you know, going, you know what I mean? And people will say, it's going to be awful. It's going to be crazy. He's going to say this crazy thing or that crazy thing. And then he ends up actually being halfway normal or something. And then they get the praise at all. You hear all the praise from CNN. Oh, I guess this didn't happen. You know what I mean? Like I don't want us to be disappointed. I don't want people to think that, you know, oh, this is gonna happen. He's gonna get impeached, or this is, you know, he's gonna get removed from office. And
no, I'm right there. I'm right there with you on that. We've been talking about that for a few days now. I think you heard the Friday on the Front Porch conversation. There's a lot of people out there talking impeachment as if it's going to happen anytime soon, if at all.
Right. And that's what I was kind of, you know, I think people need to really hold off on that kind of assumptions, not assumptions, but like it. I feel like people are too gleeful. Like it reminds me of during the election, like whenever he would have a big, like a fumble or something, like, or when, remember, like the how ridiculous he would behave during the debates and stuff. And then everybody, they like what Michael Moore said, it was like everybody was doing a end zone dance at the 50-yard line or at the halfway mark. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, and let's, like, let's understand something about what Mueller is doing, if we could, please.
Sure.
He's got a job to do, and he is conducting his investigation with as little leakage as possible. He is apparently presenting evidence to grand juries. There's more than one of them. Apparently one in D.C. Yeah. and one in Virginia, at least.
But is that having anything to do with Trump, though? You know what I mean? Like Donald himself?
Well, it's part of the investigation. And usually when, you build an investigation like this the same way you build a pyramid. You do not start, if you think of Trump as the apex of the pyramid, you don't hang the capstone of the pyramid in air and then build the pyramid underneath it. You build the pyramid right. by establishing a firm and secure, broad base, and then you start stacking stones until you're ready to put the capstone on it. Okay? And along the way, and that I think it's a viable theory that part of the Arpaio pardon had to do with letting other people know, listen, you know, if Mueller leans on you, just, you know, take whatever comes and, you know, I'll pardon you.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a gamble, though, because he can't necessarily pardon everybody. And if something really big happens, then, you know, he could, if we had a Congress that was serious about its oath to the Constitution, he could be gone quicker than we can imagine. I'm kind of contradicting myself from earlier, but I hope you understand why. But just to finish the idea, he's doing his investigation. He's presenting cases to the grand jury. And no, he's not holding daily press conferences because that is not what special prosecutors typically do. Ken Starr, during the Clinton years, was an exception, not the rule. So with that in mind, as long as he doesn't get fired, which has been made more difficult, then he's going to do his work. And if but here's where it gets important. Beyond whatever it is that a grand jury does, and criminal charges are not likely to be brought via grand jury against Donald Trump because he's a sitting president. The question, constitutionally, the question is not entirely settled, but it would certainly be a new thing.
Well,
just to finish real quick.
Is there precedent?
Just to finish real quick. He would also, he could be expected to present a report to the Congress. Now, as I've noted in the past, impeachment is a political process, not a legal one. And this
right.
is and this is where I think all the hopes of impeachment fall apart. He could present a complete report, 50 feet thick, with black and white, color glossy photographs with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and it would just lay there and gather dust. Because the Republican majority controls the House of Representatives. The Senate can't do a goddamn thing because they don't initiate impeachment. The House does. And if Paul Ryan, in the hopes of getting tax cuts for the people who pay his who write him checks, decides to let it lay there and lets the word filter out that ain't nothing going to be done about this, no how, no way, then there you are.
Right. Well, you know, it's that's where I get a little bit worried because people like Stephanie Miller,
It's okay. I mean, we talk about it. It's all right.
You know, I like her and I listen to her show.
I mean, it's not like I'm going to be taken off her Christmas card list. I'm not on it, so I've got nothing to fear there.
Well, she actually hung up on me because I tried to tell her what I told you the other night. You know, we gotta stop thinking about this impeachment stuff because it's being hyped up on our side. And too many times have people on our side hyped something up that they thought was going to happen to Trump, and it just nothing just fell flat on his face. That's kind of what I was trying to articulate. And she hung up on me because she thought I was a concerned troll. And, you know, and that's – but I just try to be objective.
I have never heard you in any way give me reason to think that you're a troll, John.
Right. Yeah. But they're like, they get a lot of trolls to call it.
I'm sure they do. She's immensely popular, and I'm sure that all kinds of maggots call all the time. Make America great again, Trumpansy scum, maggots.
I'd
be as concerned. But the fact of the matter is, maybe if you had called in and said, and been a little bit more strident or freaked out or whatever, and said, just which Republicans do you think are going to initiate fucking impeachment proceedings? Tell me one.
Yeah.
Tell me what it is that makes you think that Paul Ryan is going to let impeachment proceedings go forward.
You're right.
Ask her, do you even know who would be who's in charge of the committee that would hear the initial report of where impeachment proceedings would begin?
Who is that?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming it would begin in the House Judiciary Committee.
Well, who's the chairman of that? You know?
Looking now, we did this the other night, and the committee is top to bottom lunatics.
Yeah, Trumpansies.
Let's see.
That's why you would need a majority. You would need Democrats to have a majority.
Yeah, the chairman is Bob Goodlatte of Virginia. And that man is crazier than a sprayed roach at a decon party.
Mike Malloy mentioned him, and he said Goodlatte, or he said Goodlatte, I guess, as opposed to Badlatte.
Yeah,
but
so it's just he would have to allow it. He would have to allow so much he'd have to allow a hearing to be had.
Yeah.
I mean, here's,
and that's never going to happen.
And we've gone through here are the Republicans. Bob Goodlatte is the chair. And he's a maggot. Jim Sensenbrenner, maggot. Lamar Smith, maggot. Steve King, maggot. Daryl Issa, maggot. Trent Franks, really big maggot. Louis Gohmert, king maggot. Jim Jordan of Ohio, maggot. Trey Gowdy, maggot. Ted Poe, maggot. Blake Farenthold, who shows up at parties in footy pajamas with duckies on them, maggot.
These people are so fucking insane.
Martha Roby, maggot. Okay?
Yeah, well, yeah. That's why we would need a majority, man. And,
impeachment doesn't... Look, please also be cognizant, John.
It never succeeded.
Please also be cognizant that there are the beginnings in the for-profit media of normalization of the idea that impeachment shouldn't even be considered.
Yeah, I know. Who's doing that? New York Times, right?
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound
there
like
was
that.
And there was a time in a history of which perhaps you're unaware when we were considering the impeachment of Ronald Reagan, and he should have been impeached. But Ben Bradley and Katherine Graham said, "Oh, America cannot stand another constitutional crisis," which was bullshit from jump, because it's not a constitutional crisis when the Constitution works as it was designed. It's a constitutional crisis, John, when it doesn't.
And it's not right now, man.
Which,
it's
right, and that's why I've been saying from January 20th onward, we have been in a constitutional crisis, we continue to be in a constitutional crisis, and we will remain in a constitutional crisis so long as Donald J. Trump remains the president of the United States of America.
That's exactly right. And you alluded to the media. I think the media, I mean, oh, man, there's a real, real scandal about the media. And you know what it is? It's they pretty much, of course, it's been talked about a lot about all the free coverage they gave him. But they hand over fist gave him so much publicity. And everybody knows in politics that whoever gets the most publicity is probably going to win or has the best chance of winning and shit.
And you know what? Mike Pencilneck Geek is not going to be nearly as fun for the for-profit media to cover, and it's not going to generate, and he could never generate nearly as much excitement as this little fucker does.
And exactly, and they're actually terrorizing the country by like normalizing what he's doing and. Like, can you imagine you being an undocumented immigrant or a Muslim person or anything, any of the groups that he has, like, you know, persecuted?
Honest to God, and I can't. I can't imagine.
Exactly.
That.
Can you imagine? I mean, like, terrified.
All I can do is empathize. I mean, I got about as much privilege as one American can have. I'm white. I'm male. I'm older. You know, ain't got no health insurance. I'm pretty privileged, and as a consequence, but dig it, I'm privileged, but I'm scared, okay, and I'm not afraid to say it. I'm not scared of him personally. I'm not afraid he's going to show up here on my doorstep and I'm calling. Yeah, well, no, we're not going to have fisticuffs by the Marcus of Queensberry rules in my front yard. And he's not going to beat my ass.
No.
But the thing is, like with the renewed saber rattling this morning against North Korea, talking's not working. Our words, we don't have beautiful words. The talking's not working. And once again, the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, had to come out and go, no, 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 no. There's always room for more diplomacy. You know, a goddamn Marine general has to say that?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's just because Trump is fucking nuts, man. Like, he thinks with himself, with his own interest in mind. Like, did you see, and I don't know if this is a true article or not. I don't know. There's a lot of fake shit online and stuff. But I saw that he's promoting his hats that he's selling. Somebody was talking about.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah, and he's probably selling the FLOTUS hat, too.
Yeah, that is so fucked up, man, for him to use that. This is like Todd was saying yesterday or last night. You know those kids went and got freaking wheelbarrows to put all the money that they're stealing from the U.S. government, from the taxpayer, just like, you know, Tiffany spent $117,000 on some trip. You know what I mean? And then you had, Marine Antoinette Mnuchin and what she was doing and shit. And they said apparently that they're going to pay back the government, but that's all lip service, man. Another thing I want to address from the other night, when I talked about, I said something that was kind of sounded fear-mongerish, and I wasn't trying to come off that way. I said about if something about there could be bloodshed over trying to wrest the country back from these people. Well, what I kind of really meant was, I don't think once we get past a cusp, I don't think we're there yet. But once you get past a certain line, like a cusp, then yeah, that would be true. And I think that we really need to be aware of that kind of thing. And I think that we need to guard against that because we are on a very slippery slope, and we have a president who has spouted off the shit that he has said. And
no, I don't think you were fear mongering. I mean, if anybody's guilty of fear mongering, it's me. But at least I'm doing least I'm doing it honestly.
We're just being pragmatic is what we're trying to do, you know, and it's you see these rallies, man, like the rallies that he's still doing, and even the ones that he was doing back then, back during the campaign season, is scary shit, man. I mean, that is like, oh, it is Orwellian, it is Hitlerian, and stuff, and like, well, I just think that we're like you keep saying that we're in a crisis, and we absolutely are, man. And one of the big factors of the crisis, one of the huge components of it, is the people that refuse to stop worshiping this guy, and also the media. You know, I can't express enough how much the media, and I like journalists, okay? You know, journalism is a virtue, of course. But what you see on the media is not journalism. It's not journalism. That is absolutely not even close to journalism. And they're basically pushing his propaganda. They are. Because, you know, he was on – they had him on talking about tax reform. They had a clip of him saying about how he wants to cut taxes, or how he thinks that the wealthy people get too much tax breaks or something like that. That's all they showed of it. You know what I mean? So that's like they showed the populist part of it. And this isn't no Fox, man. Like, my parents watch like local like shit. You know what I mean? Like, it's not Fox or anything. And I've noticed that the media pushes propaganda for him. And I don't know if they realize they're doing it or what, you know? And I just think that we're living in very dangerous times. And you said the other day, if he's not removed from office, the country is done. And I believe that is absolutely correct.
And I mean, I don't like saying that, but look, I mean, this is just where I am. I'm not saying it's where anybody else is. Every night, Agnes and I go to sleep. We've developed this thing now where instead of watching something really serious before bed or anything, we try to find something funny. The last three nights have found us watching old comedy specials from Craig Ferguson. I don't know why it makes us laugh, but it does. So we go to bed laughing, and part of it is because at this point in time, we don't know when we're going to wake up dead.
Oh man.
Okay. I mean, the first, you know, I wake up, you know, I, you know, we don't have kids to get off to school anymore or anything. So I don't have alarm clocks set or anything. I just naturally wake up about 6:30, 7 o'clock. And I reach over and I grab the tablet and I open it up and I turn it on and I fire it up and I put it on that filthy little I put it on my filthy little habit and I watch it and I'm like, oh, okay, nothing's on fire. They're not talking about the nuclear war having started. But you get the idea. The first thing I do is to check in to see if that crazy little bastard has involved our poor country in something.
Right, like that show or the movie or show. You're referring to, you know, you remember that? You said a couple of times, oh, dear, that little bastard involved your poor father in?
Right, that's what that line is from. It's from The In-Laws, 1978, 1979, Nancy Dussault, and she says, that crazy little bastard's involved your poor father in something.
Right.
Well, we're there now.
Yes. Hey, is it wrong that I actually kind of like Joe Scarborough? You know what I mean? Like, he comes off sort of likable to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wouldn't mind having somebody
like
that
as a president. It is okay, because I've got a dear friend that's been a dear friend for 30 years and more, and he reminds me of him. Only my dear friend is even more fascist than Scarborough is. I mean, you know, he thinks Social Security's communism.
Oh, God, man.
You know, real hardcore type. But we've been friends too long to just, you know, anyway. I'll get email. I get a kick out of the program. It beats the living shit out of trying to watch Fox and Friends.
No,
and there's nothing
that.
Else, and I don't get network TV on, you know, I mean, you know, over the air networks. I don't get that on DirecTV now. So even if it was available today in Good Morning America and CBS This Morning, you know, my only other opportunity is like CNN, and I'm sorry, the Cuomo guy and Allison Camarota don't do it for me. There's just nothing that I don't. It just no.
Oh, I can't stand her. She is such a freaking Trump supporter, Kyler. It's like she gets on her freaking knees for them. Not to sound, no, I'm sorry, that was sexist, man. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. You know, but I mean,
I admit I tune in for the, and they do. I mean, it's deliberate, it's marketing. You know, they've set up this thing where, you know, you're watching, it's like you're watching a rock-ribbed Republican husband and his more liberal-ish wife, and they sort of spat with each other over breakfast, and you're sort of a vicarious witness to it all. And, you know, she was making some really, really interesting faces. She did everything but stick her tongue out at him this morning. And you know, the same thing that makes people watch soap operas, you know, I watched that, you know. And once in a while, they have an a senator like Joe Manchin come on and embarrass himself or something. And it's, you know, it's fun to tweet at him, whatever. But, you know, I never, ever, ever make the mistake of thinking Joe Scarborough is anything but what he was, is, and always will be. And that is a Newt Gingrich Republican. You know, the fact of the matter is, a whole lot of what's, you know, you can't blame everything on Trump. A whole lot of what's wrong with this country starts with the Newt Gingrich contract on America, in which he was a young and up and coming star at the time.
Right. Yeah. Well,
the conniption that he and Mika both had yesterday, screaming at Antifa snowflakes, blaming them for the Nazis who came to provoke them in Berkeley. It's just like, oh, Jesus, really?
No way. Did they really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, Mika and Joe were both. Yeah, they were screaming, you know, because they were suppressing the free speech rights of Nazis.
Wow. See, that's the kind of shit right there where you get into the normalization thing, and that's dangerous. That's the slippery slope we're on, the normalization of the fascism. And, you know, that's tragic, man. And we need to be alarmed from that. Look, I know that we're about the end of the program, so I'm going to get off of here. And thanks for taking my call and everything. And I probably will be on the front porch Friday then. So.
All right, cool. I'll look forward to it. You take care, John. Bye now.
Yep, you too, bud.
And so we close the program with John from Central PA. Time to get out of here. It's been a fun prayer meeting Wednesday. I hope it's been fun for you. And we'll be back for Thorn in the Side Thursday tomorrow. We're almost out of August. Tomorrow will be the last installment of August 2017. And a quick reminder, we'll be here on Labor Day, just so you know. Thanks to everybody who makes this program go. Thanks to all of you who support the program. There was no fundraising tonight, per my promise. Thank you to everybody who listens and participates, however you do. The program's for everybody, not just the people who contribute. But thank you to those who do, because that makes it possible for everybody else, you know, who doesn't. Not that I'm casting any aspersions. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you very kindly, Steve from Georgia Stan, Midweek Utility, Prayer Meeting Wednesday, chat room moderator, and all-around great guy. Thank you very kindly to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch. Thank you, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch on Facebook, and at Coal River MTN on Twitter. And remember, if you shop at Amazon, go to smile.amazon.com, nominate Coal River Mountain Watch, and Every time you use smile.amazon.com, Colerate Mountain Launch will get a little teeny tiny bit of the proceeds of your sale, and you'll be supporting grassroots activism for justice in the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone of Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.